For Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Miller reporting. Voters in the U.S. southern state of Alabama are choosing a senator Tuesday to replace Jeff Sessions, who became attorney general in a race that could have far-reaching national implications. The race pits controversial Republican Roy Moore, who is battling sexual harassment allegations, against Democrat Doug Jones, a former prosecutor. Moore commented on why so many were focused on the election.
Because it's the first senatorial election after the election of President Donald Trump. We know they're not moving in Washington. We know that we want them to move in Washington, but they're putting a lot of money to keep what's there without change.
Moore has denied several allegations of sexual misconduct when he was in his 30s involving women who were teenagers at the time. Supporters of the Paris Climate Agreement criticized U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the historic accord during a summit outside the French capital. Former Secretary of State John Kerry said Trump's move was not based on common sense.
It is a self-destructive decision for political purposes.
Trump announced in June his plans to secede from the climate pact, saying the agreement would have cost American trillions of dollars, killed jobs, and hindered the oil, gas, coal, and manufacturing industries. 27-year-old Bangladeshi immigrant Akayat Ullah has been charged in the Monday attack at the Port Authority bus terminal in Manhattan. The New York Police Department tweeted Ullah was charged with criminal possession of a weapon, supporting an act of terrorism, and making a terroristic threat. This is VOA News. Many Rohingya families who have fled to Bangladesh from Myanmar are marrying off their daughters early to ease the financial burden of looking after them. Philip Alexio has that story.
Girls as young as 12 years old from the refugee families are being married off so that their parents have fewer children to feed at home. Since the military launched the first round of clearance operations in Rakhine last year, over 700,000 Rohingya have fled Myanmar. More than 625,000 of them fled to Bangladesh after the latest outbreak of violence in Rakhine in August, which, according to United Nations Human Rights, could contain elements of genocide against the Rohingya Muslims. Rohingya refugees who have fled Myanmar since last year are now living in makeshift bamboo and plastic shacks in the refugee camps spread across southeastern Bangladesh. Many of these families with a large number of children complain that the ration they get from the United Nations World Food Program is not enough and that they are going through a food shortage. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
Andrew Palcheski reports two Palestinian Islamic Jihad militants riding on a motorcycle in Gaza were killed in an explosion on Tuesday.
Israel's military denied accounts by local residents that they were killed in an airstrike. Violence along the Israel-Gaza border has flared since U.S. President Donald Trump's recognition last week of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and the Israeli military's demolition on Sunday of a cross-border tunnel it said was dug by Hamas, the Islamist group that controls the small coastal enclave. On Monday, Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system intercepted a rocket fired by militants in Gaza. Shortly afterwards, Israel responded with tank fire and airstrikes targeting positions of Hamas. After the explosion on Tuesday that killed the two militants, an Israeli military statement said, contrary to Palestinian reports, the Israel Defense Forces did not attack in the northern Gaza Strip. Andrew Palcheski, VOA News.
A new survey in the U.S. shows that nearly 6 in 10 Americans believe that the level of government corruption has risen in the year since President Donald Trump was elected. Transparency International said its poll of 1,000 people in October and November showed that while Trump was elected on a vow to make government work better for those who feel their interests had been neglected, the opposite has happened. The European Union is withdrawing financial help to Cambodia's Electoral Commission in response to a recent dissolution of the country's main opposition party. The EU said a process in which the opposition party has been arbitrarily excluded from next July's parliamentary elections cannot be seen as legitimate. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
this particular summit is called the One Planet Summit. It's really to give, if you like, a bit of a push to the Paris Climate Change Agreement, which was signed here in Paris 2 years ago.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. We'll have full details coming up.
Also in the Gambia, school authorities and students recently took part in a forum to address the issue of lack of discipline in country schools. And organizations working with Zimbabwean migrants in South Africa say the main reason most are choosing to remain in their more affluent neighbor is job opportunities.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, French President Emmanuel Macron gathered business leaders and 50 world leaders in Paris for a summit today. The focus of the meeting was on boosting funding to fight climate change. The summit comes 2 years after nearly 200 nations agreed to the Paris Climate Accord. It calls for nations to limit greenhouse gas emissions and for rich countries to help developing countries deal with the impacts of climate change. U.S. President Donald Trump was not among those invited to take part in the conference. Last year, Trump announced the U.S. was pulling out of the accord, saying it disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries. Reporter Catherine Field is in Paris covering the summit. She spoke with me about the important role developing countries play in mitigating climate issues.
This particular summit is called the One Planet Summit. It's really to give, if you like, a bit of a push to the Paris Climate Change Agreement, which was signed here in Paris 2 years ago. The French President Emmanuel Macron has, if you like, he's tried to establish himself as the man who can push the rest of the world into agreeing to really get on top of climate change. Just within the last 24 hours, the French president said that the real impetus for this was when the American president decided to walk away from that Paris agreement. Emmanuel Macron said that this really created, if you like, a huge momentum to create a counter-momentum, to really get on top of everything that needs to be done to get climate change under control. And in that respect, he wants to get all these leaders together, particularly also your local mayors who've also come here, your local businesses, to get them to come together and particularly to talk about the financial issues. That means raising money to give to developing countries to help them with their clean energy, to, if you like, also keep an eye on some of the development banks and make sure that they're not lending money to countries so as they can open new coal plants. And it's matters like that, particularly the financing, that Emmanuel Macron says is so important now because, as he put it, he doesn't want people to come to him in 20 to 30 years' time and to say, you did nothing. He feels that now is the time to do something.
Well, one big example is the Burkina Faso example. Can you tell us about this and what is going on there regarding climate change?
The one particular resource that Burkina Faso has, like most of the Sahel region, is sunshine. And just in late November, Emmanuel Macron was in Burkina Faso, and he was there for this particular solar power plant on the outskirts of the capital, Ouagadougou, when it came on stream. This is a huge solar power plant, 55 hectares. And what it will do in particular is it will cut energy dependence and it will boost renewables. So one of the things that the French Development Agency did was it funded half of this particular project. It funded $25 million of this. The remainder of it, this financing, came from the European Union. So what Emmanuel Macron is going to say to the delegates today is he's going to say, look, you know, this is something concrete. When this is really at maximum capacity, it will mean that Burkina Faso has a lot of its energy needs coming from solar. The whole object of this is that by 2030, Burkina Faso will have 30% of its energy needs coming from solar. It will also mean that this particular country, it doesn't have the energy dependence. At the moment, Burkina Faso gets a lot of its energy from Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. So this big project, which France helped finance, that was really there, is what he's going to hold up as saying, you can't just tell these countries to do more. You have to help them with the new technology. And in that way, France, and of course also China, is absolutely there at the forefront, helping, not just handing over the money, but saying, okay, here's how we can work together. And I think that is really the next move that Emmanuel Macron is going to be holding up and saying, okay, let's look at these countries that are developing. Let's look at the resources they have there. And let's work with them to use those resources.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris.
In the Gambia, school authorities and students recently took part in a forum to address the lack of discipline in the country's schools. The national state broadcaster, the Gambia Radio and Television Services, organized the meeting, which it called Face the Nation. English to Africa reporter Pandera Mbai reports.
The forum followed the expulsion of a high school female student following what school authorities call inappropriate dancing with a male student. 10 orders from various schools were also suspended for misbehavior. Karomo Bojang is the principal of Nusrat High School in the town of Bundunkakunda.
Discipline in schools involves the student's ability to obey school rules, to respect teachers, to be able to carry their schoolwork according to what they are asked to do. The moment any student who violates that, we consider the student as an indisciplined student.
The forum brought together schools within the Greater Banjul area. Its goal was to investigate the main causes of misbehavior and to propose solutions to the problem. Veteran retired Gambian educationist Omar Ndur notes that the issue of indiscipline in schools should be approached critically.
Yes, discipline is going down and we must find a solution to it. If society is getting rotten, I think the answer should be from the schools, because these are the seeds of tomorrow Gambia, and we need to bring them up with the good morals.
Saini Giba belongs to a group called Gambian Association of Teachers of English.
I think we need to bring back counseling, because I think counseling needs to be strengthened. Some of these children, from where they are coming from, they need to be counseled. The schools, honestly, have a big role to play in supporting these children to become very responsible.
Some say the problem relates to a lack of proper parenting. They say there is a lack of decorum among some spouses that influence their children. Others, like this student, blames the exposure of students to foreign cultures and lifestyles, including the West and neighboring countries like Nigeria.
My blame goes to our parents and the school administration. In this case, like, a student spent most of his time at home. So if at all that a student has been treated well at home with good morals and behavior, there is no way that I can see if a student go to school, he or she will be influenced with misbehaviors.
Another student, Ablai Gay, says another problem regards to male teachers socializing or dating with female students. Most schools have rules against this, though some students are not comfortable complaining against adult predators.
How can students be disciplined while teachers themselves are dating students in the school? Teachers date students in the school, and also students visit teachers at their houses.
At the end of the meeting, participants urge parents to attend school parent meetings and to track their children's performance and behavior. They also urge parents to instill in young people good values and manners. In the early 70s leading to the 80s, corporal punishment was enforced in Gambian schools. It was later abolished by the former administration of President Sir Dauda Kairaba Jawara. Today, teachers and parents are concerned that the pendulum has swung from strict codes of behavior to too much freedom, bordering on lack of respect and indiscipline. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
The human rights organization Amnesty International accuses European governments of being complicit in the torture and abuse of tens of thousands of refugees and migrants detained in Libya in appalling conditions. The group published a report today on the issue entitled Libya's Dark Web of Collusion. It details and says how European governments are actively supporting the Libyan Coast Guard, detention authorities, and smugglers in order to prevent people from crossing the Mediterranean. I spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome about this report.
Yes, this is a damning report from Amnesty International released today, accusing European governments of complicity in the detention and torture of migrants in Libya, particularly by assisting the Libyan Coast Guard, which has been implicated in people trafficking, and sending migrants back to Libya. Now, the rights group said that these governments are knowingly complicit in the torture and the abuse of tens of thousands of refugees and migrants that have been detained by the Libyan authorities in what they call were appalling conditions in Libya. Also accused the European governments of actively supporting a sophisticated system of abuse and exploitation by the Libyan Coast Guard and smugglers to prevent these people from crossing the Mediterranean. So these are very strong words from Amnesty. And Amnesty's Europe director, John Dalhuisen, said that these refugees and migrants, as we know, are trapped in Libya and they're at the mercy of the Libyan authorities and the militias that are really just using and abusing them for financial gain.
And what has been the response to this accusation?
So far, the response has been quite muted, but this year, the Italian government has been very defensive and very proud of its decision to change its policy to stop the migrant boats from crossing the Mediterranean, to work with the Libyan government, to work with the Libyan Coast Guard and push the migrants back, mostly sub-Saharan migrants, back to Libya. Now, the Italian government has its eye on national elections, which are due to be held in Italy early next year. And this is a very clear attempt by politicians in Italy to show the voters that more is being done to control the migrant crisis and try and attract that vote, that disillusioned vote, particularly from Italians who are unemployed or struggling to make ends meet. This government and these politicians in Italy want to send a message that they are handling this crisis. And that's why, unfortunately, the migrants, I think, have been at the receiving end of what is a very harsh policy.
I understand also some new numbers have come out today regarding the migrants. Can you shed some light on this information?
Yes, the Italian government has released fresh figures showing that 117,500 migrants have so far arrived in Italy this year. That's compared to 175,000 for the same period in 2016. That's a drop of 33%. The fall that we have seen has been even more dramatic since July, August this year when the Italian government started clamping down on the arrivals.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wahib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Today, French President Emmanuel Macron gathered business leaders and 50 world leaders in Paris for a summit to boost funding to fight climate change. In the Gambia, school authorities and students recently took part in a forum to address the lack of discipline in the country's schools. And the human rights organization Amnesty International accuses European governments of being complicit in the torture and abuse of tens of thousands of refugees and migrants detained in Libya. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
More news around the continent. Organizations working with Zimbabwean migrants in South Africa say the main reason most are choosing to remain with their more affluent neighbor is job opportunities. The African Center for Migration and Society in Johannesburg, for example, says Zimbabweans will only begin returning to the country of their birth in big numbers once the economy there improves dramatically. An estimated 2 million Zimbabweans now live in South Africa. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Grass flies as a burly man in a blue overall soaked with sweat mows the lawn at a house in a Johannesburg suburb. Mike Dube arrived in the city from Bulawayo with his family 15 years ago. Groups protecting the rights of Zimbabweans in South Africa say most of the migrants are employed informally, for example as farm laborers. In the cities, many Zimbabwean men, like Dube, work as gardeners. He says he likes working outdoors, even though it's tough physical labor.
Cleaning, digging, taking the weeds out, yeah, and cleaning the swimming pool.
Dube says he's heard stories about South Africans paying Zimbabweans so-called slave wages. But he says South Africa and its people have been good to him since he started work in Johannesburg 15 years ago.
I'm getting lunch, money, and breakfast. Get a wife and 3 children here. He's gone to school, he's finished school, he's all right, no problem here. Yeah.
He says his family had no choice but to leave Bulawayo.
It's very bad because sometimes it's short for food, no money to pay everything, school. If he is going to the clinic, can't find the medicine. Other people is dying and everything.
In South Africa, his family is doing well. Dube and his 2 sons are gardeners. His wife's a domestic helper, and his daughter's a trainee chef. He says these jobs, as menial as they are hard to come by in Zimbabwe. But Dube insists he still loves Zimbabwe and returns regularly.
Every year, June, I'm going to Zimbabwe. In December, you see, all like family. Then I'm coming back.
Packing leaves in a plastic bag, he says it's Zimbabwe's poor economy and lack of development that always disappoint him.
No, it's worse. It's worse, worse, worse. But yeah, it's better because you get everything here. Yeah. And then you get money to send to Zimbabwe to buy some mealie. Every month, send money there.
Dube says most Zimbabweans he speaks with about the recent political changes in their homeland have the same opinion as he does.
If Mugabe was out, I'm happy. Because Mugabe, he don't care about the people. Otherwise, he's changed a little bit.
As he trims another patch of grass, Dube laughs and says he won't return to Zimbabwe because he doesn't trust crocodiles. The joke's aimed at the country's new leader, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who's nicknamed the Crocodile for his political ruthlessness. Dube says if Mnangagwa proves to be as dedicated to improving all Zimbabweans' lives as he is to his political career, then maybe a move back to Bulawayo will be more than just a dream. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
New York is a magnet for immigrants looking for freedom and opportunity in the U.S. At the same time, American life is enriched by the diverse cultures and fresh perspectives that immigrants bring. Adam Phillips reports.
That's a video recording of South African children in a township participating in one of Dramatic Needs workshops. A world away in New York's Carnegie Hall, Amber Sainsbury, Dramatic Needs founder, takes a break from rehearsing the children's monologues to explain that it's not only food, clothing, and medicine that traumatized and impoverished children need.
We're not suggesting for a minute that we airdrop art materials into war zones, but once they have the basic necessities of life, but life is still incredibly hard and trauma continues to occur, we believe that there's a merit to using the arts, which are a very gentle way for children to learn and to express themselves and to thereby cope with what they're going through.
Sainsbury says children often find it difficult to put the trauma they've suffered into words.
But they can, if given enough freedom and space, make a mark on a piece of paper or sing a song or present a character that has a thoroughfare between what they've gone through and what their audience is receiving. And there's something inherently therapeutic about that.
In a 2015 London performance of the children's monologues, the British rapper Lil Sims reprised one child's thoughts this way.
Wait, nah, this is our story, this is our fate, this is our kingdom, this is our place, this is our freedom, cut off their chains, this is our struggle, this is our pain, this is our love, this is our trust, this is our daughters.
Many famous actors have performed at Dramatic Need fundraisers. They include Daniel Kaluuya, Trevor Noah, Susan Sarandon, and Nicole Kidman. Here, Benedict Cumberbatch dramatizes one South African child's memory of slaughter in his township.
I don't like to think what might have happened to my friend, what might have happened to the other people that disappeared from my village. I don't like to have that thought in my brain. The bodies that they find every week, rotting in the fields.
In one story, a girl recounts repeated sexual abuse by her uncle. She was afraid to tell her grandmother about it because her rapist was supposed to be the family's protector. Male actor Kit Harington dramatizes the story.
When I was 13 years old, I was raped. It was my uncle, my grandmother's son. He climbed in my window in the middle of the night and it isn't a big enough word to say what he did.
Sainsbury says this girl's odyssey from trauma to healing has been a deeply moving personal story for her as well.
We have worked with her now for over 5 years, and I have seen an extraordinary recovery of self and spirit from her. She is coping incredibly well. We were out there in January and saw her, and she did a beat poetry performance, and it was one of the most moving things that I've ever seen, and I'm so proud of her, and she is an extraordinary example of courageousness and resilience.
Some use dance to move toward recovery. The Via Vondels Pansula dance crew, heard here demonstrating their moves offstage in Carnegie Hall, expresses the emotional range in their art. Pansula dance evolved in South Africa's black townships as a form of exuberant, high-energy protest during the apartheid era. Sindile Nolunga leads the troupe.
Like, the way we dance is the way we show how we live, you see. So whatever we see in the neighborhood, whatever we see local, we do on stage just to show people, like, how we live. All the pain I'm feeling, I'm going to show you the pain through dance. Mm-hmm. All the happiness I'm feeling, I'm going to show you through dance. Through my dance, through my body, is the language to your eyes and your mind.
For most of its 10-year history, Dramatic Need has worked in South Africa and Rwanda. But it's now opening a branch office in the Bronx in New York, one of the poorest districts in America. According to Amber Sainsbury, bravery is a human quality and freedom is a human right. And that stands true regardless of the color of your skin, the passport you carry, or the language you use to tell your story. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Also, today you can watch a live stream of the U.S. Senate's hearing on Zimbabwe's political developments starting at 1900 UTC on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Indabele, and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com, voaindebele.com, and voashona.com.
Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on The Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening, and welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. The Confederation of African Football will hold its annual awards ceremony on January 4th in Accra, Ghana. An Egyptian player, though, already has won a big prize. Liverpool striker Mohamed Salah won the BBC African Footballer of the Year award for 2017. The 25-year-old Salah was presented with the trophy at Liverpool's training ground by the English Premier League club's German manager, Jurgen Klopp. Salah is leading the Premier League in scoring this season with 13 goals. He also helped the Pharaohs of Egypt qualify for the World Cup for the first time since 1990. Current and past members of the Pharaohs praise Salah for winning the award. Arsenal midfielder Mohamed Elneny wrote on Twitter, "Best African player, proud of you, bro." Omar Gaber, a defender who plays for Major League Soccer's Los Angeles FC, also wrote on Twitter, "Congratulations! Well-deserved, Picasso!" And former Egyptian star Mohamed Aboutrika, who is now an assistant coach with the Pharaohs, wrote this tweet, "Congratulations! You made us proud! The best is yet to come." And who knows? The best for Mohamed Salah could come with Liverpool in the UEFA Champions League tournament, or perhaps with Egypt at the 2018 World Cup in Russia. As I mentioned during Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, Liverpool has been drawn against Porto of Portugal in the round of 16 in the UEFA Champions League. And in what's shaping up as a very exciting round of 16 matchup, defending champion Real Madrid of Spain will play Paris Saint-Germain, which is currently leading the French league. PSG's assistant sporting director and former player, the Brazilian Maxwell, sizes up Real Madrid.
I think they have many, many, many qualities. They have a lot of strength, quality players. They have also, we know that when they play home, they have a lot of offensive power. But we have our qualities, we have our players, our ambition to continue in this competition. So we're going to do everything. We have a staff that knows them very well from Spain. So I think we have all the qualities also to go through to the next round.
Meanwhile, Real Madrid's Director of Institutional Relations, Emilio Butragueno, says PSG most definitely will be a challenging opponent with quality players at every position.
I think they are really very strong in every department of the field. They are very solid in defense, very talented in the midfield, and offensively they have players that are able to win a match on their own. So we have to be at our best if we want to qualify, but at the same time I would like to underline that we are the holders and our players, they always rise to the occasion. I'm sure they are going to play very well and live up to our fans' expectations.
That's Emilio Butragueno, the director of institutional relations for 12-time European football champion Real Madrid. And Emilio was talking in Switzerland at Monday's UEFA Champions League draw. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Just ahead, we'll take a look back at this year's IAAF World Championships in Athletics in London. Turning to athletics, the year's most important competition took place in August when London staged the IAAF World Championships in Athletics. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2017, we'll hear from some of the athletes who earned acclaim in the British capital, and we begin with a 6-time Olympic champion from the United States.
Well, it's always fun to run the 4x4, and you never really feel great by this time of the championships, but it's just all about getting out there with your teammates. You know, there's something special about that. So just dug deep and wanted to, you know, have a good leg for my team.
That's American Allison Felix, the most decorated athlete in the history of the IAAF World Championships. Felix won 2 gold medals and 1 bronze at the championships. On the final day of competition in the British capital, Felix won gold in the 4x400 meters team relay, a day after winning gold in the 4x100 meters team relay. Allison also earned a bronze medal in the women's 400 meters final to give her a record 16 medals at the World Championships. Allison Felix has also won 9 Olympic medals, including 6 gold, during her great athletics career. She says she would like to hang up her track spikes after the 2020 Tokyo Games in Japan.
Well, I would love to make it to 2020. That's kind of my goal. I would love to end my career there. And so, but, you know, I'm just kind of seeing where life takes me. And as long as I'm enjoying it and having fun and still, you know, at an elite level, then I'm happy to continue to reach that goal. So that's kind of my mindset.
Allison Felix was one of the veterans on a USA team that dominated the medals table at London 2017. The Americans won 30 medals total in London, nearly 3 times as many as second-place Kenya. Breaking down those 30 medals, Team USA tallied 10 gold, 11 silver, and 9 bronze. As I told my friend Maxwell on Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Nigeria, I know USA Track and Field, the governing body for athletics here in the USA, must be very pleased with the performance of the American squad in London. In addition to those gold medals in the women's 4x100 meters and 4x400 meters team relays, 5 American women won gold medals in individual events. Let's give them shout-outs. Emma Coburn, the surprise winner in the 3,000-meter steeplechase, Brittany Reese in the long jump, Phyllis Francis in the 400 meters, Corey Carter in the 400 meters hurdles, and Tori Bowie in the 100 meters dash.
I kind of had an idea, but I didn't know. I didn't want to get up celebrating too soon. It looked crazy. So I just kind of like wait until, you know, just sat down and waited till they put on the board to confirm it. You know, and at that moment, I was like, it finally happened. Finally, everything's finally paid off. All the sacrifices.
In men's results at the World Championships in London, three Americans won gold. Justin Gatlin in the 100 meters dash, Sam Kendricks in the pole vault, and Christian Taylor in the triple jump. In the 100 meters, Gatlin knelt on the track and then bowed to the retiring Jamaican superstar Usain Bolt, who won the bronze medal and later hurt his left leg in the 4x100 meters team relay. A disappointing end to maybe the greatest athletics career of all time. The silver medalist in the 100 meters, Christian Coleman of the USA, praised Bolt.
You know, he's done some things that, you know, 20 years ago, you know, not many people would even, you know, thought could be done. You know, he has the record in the 100 and 200, so, you know, he's pretty much like the greatest of all time, you know, right now, so.
The 60,000 fans at the Olympic Stadium cheered for Usain Bolt in his final world championship, and the Lightning Bolt heard their cheers.
For me, it was brilliant, you know what I mean? The support hasn't changed, you know what I mean? I expected this. It's just really sad that I have to walk away now. But the energy of the crowd was outstanding as always, and I really love them. They made me feel so at home and so welcome. My fans really love me, and I really appreciate that. For me, I was saying goodbye to the fans, and for me, I'm just saying goodbye to my events also. These are my two events that I've dominated for years, so I was just saying goodbye to everything, you know what I mean? I think I almost cried. It was close, but it didn't come. but I was just saying goodbye. That's pretty much it. I was saying goodbye to my events.
Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, reporter Samson Omale will take a look at some of the African highlights at the World Athletics Championships.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Reporter Samson Omale joins us now with some of the African highlights at the 10-day World Athletics Championships in London.
Kenya came in second behind the United States on the overall medal table with 5 gold, 2 silver, and 4 bronze medals. South Africa took the third spot with 3 gold, 1 silver, 4 bronze medal. On the final night, Asbel Kiprop failed in his bid for a fourth consecutive 1,500 meters gold medal, but Kenya still celebrated a dazzling 1-2 finish with new champion Elijah Manangoi leading home Timothy Cheruiyot in 3 minutes 33.61 seconds.
To become a world champion, it's not a very big, not an easy thing, you know. It's not a joke. I've trained well, up and down. So I'm really happy about becoming world champion.
Olympic 5,000 meters medalist Kenya's Helen Obiri claimed her first major when she ran a tactical race to dethrone Ethiopian Almaz Ayana of the world 5,000 meters title.
I think I'm so great. It means a lot for me because I've training hard. This year I was focusing to win world championships. My dream was to win, and I've done it.
In the 800 meters event, Caster Semenya won her third world title using her finishing trick to sweep past Niyonsaba, Burundi. Semenya won with a season-leading 1 minute 55.16 seconds.
Of course, this is a perfect ending. You know, we had a bronze in Tau 5, gold in 800 meters. Obviously, we're the best in a 2-lap. So we quite thrilled with the performance. We happy with the PB. It's a national record. It's amazing, you know. It's all about hard work and dedication.
Speaking shortly after picking up her silver medal in the 800 meters event, Francine Niyonsaba of Burundi said she was excited at the opportunity to have a podium finish at the World Championships.
This medal, I think, it is a key for the Burundians. All Burundians are very happy. I knew all Burundians were watching me, so I'm so excited.
I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. In National Basketball Association action Monday night, the Chicago Bulls surprised the visiting Boston Celtics 108-85. It was only the sixth win of the season for the Bulls against 20 losses. Chicago is tied with the Atlanta Hawks for the worst record in the NBA. The Celtics, meanwhile, have 23 wins, the most in the NBA, against only six losses. One reason for this loss is the Celtics played without their star point guard, Kyrie Irving, who was sidelined because of a bruised left quadriceps muscle. One of Chicago's international players, Nikola Mirotic, led the way on Monday night with 24 points. Mirotic has an interesting international background. He was born in Montenegro, and he represented Spain at last year's Rio Olympics basketball tournament. Bobby Portis added a career-high 23 points for the Bulls, who won their third straight game. Elsewhere around the NBA Monday night, the Houston Rockets won their 10th consecutive game, rallying for a 130-123 victory over the visiting New Orleans Pelicans. Clint Capella scored a career-high 28 points for the Rockets, while James Harden, still sporting my favorite beard in basketball, scored 26 points, including 12 straight points for Houston in the fourth quarter. James Harden also tied a career-high with 17 assists. Harden is currently leading the NBA in scoring at 32 points per game. He's also second in the league in assists with 9.5 each game, just behind Oklahoma City's Russell Westbrook, who is averaging 9.8 assists per game. Westbrook scored 30 points and had 7 assists on Monday night, but it wasn't enough, as the Charlotte Hornets scored a 116-103 road victory over the Oklahoma City Thunder. Joining us once again on the show is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be here with you.
Welcome back, Andrew. What's trending on this Tuesday?
Well, you talked about earlier Mohamed Salah getting that BBC award. Congratulations to him on that. And a lot of congratulations coming in on social media. One person sent out on social media that these are the awards that Mohamed Salah has won this year. He's been the 3-time Liverpool Player of the Month, 2-time Champions League Player of the Week, Premier Leaguer of the Month, and now the BBC African Footballer of the Year. So 2017 has been very kind to him. In fact, one fan even called him the Egyptian Messi. So
Egyptian Messi.
Yeah, quite a nice thing to be compared to Lionel Messi, of course, one of the greats of the game. But as we see, anytime any of these awards are handed out, there are many people saying it should have gone to their favorite player and said, one tweet said Victor Moses, a finalist for the award, plays for Chelsea, and the Super Eagles of Nigeria should have won for his talents on the field. Then some thinking Salah's Liverpool teammate, Sadio Mane of Senegal, should have won. So you see a lot of that handicapping, but by and large, a lot of congratulations going out to Mohamed Salah on the award.
And the common denominator among those players you mentioned, Andrew, we hopefully will see all of them at the World Cup in Russia. All their teams qualified for Russia 2018, Senegal, Nigeria, Egypt. So I think that's going to be nice to see those top African stars showing their skills on the biggest stage in football.
Absolutely. And a big qualification for Egypt. I think it's the first time in nearly 30 years that they've qualified for the World Cup. So that's going to be a team to watch, I think, especially now that Mohamed Salah is picking up all these awards.
And just to point out, maybe he'll pick up more hardware in Ghana early in 2018 when the Confederation of African Football will hold its annual award ceremony. They give out the award for African Footballer of the Year and also African Player based in Africa, two different awards. So Mohamed Salah would be up for that African Footballer of the Year prize, the biggest prize to be awarded in Accra. What else is trending, Andrew?
Well, We talk a lot on the show about Serena Williams, and with good reason, because she, of course, has more Grand Slam tournament titles in the Open era than any man or woman with 23. She leads the pack overall. And, of course, the hope is that she is going to be returning in January to tennis after having her first child this past year, so she can try for number 24 at the Australian Open. Even the tournament's director, as we talked about last week, said that he expects her to play, but we haven't heard anything from Serena or her team on whether or not she'll be there. But we might have, Sonny, as of yesterday, gotten a little bit of confirmation that she will be there from none other than Serena herself.
Okay.
Because on Monday, she posted a close-up photo on Instagram. It's a pair of legs, which I presume are hers, taken from the knees down. And at the end of those legs are a pair of white Nike tennis shoes with a big swatch of sparkly gold running from about the middle of the shoe up the back through the heel. And the caption that goes with that photo, Sonny, says, "Be excited. Be very excited. Dot, dot, dot." So
even I'm excited.
I'm excited. I mean, you know, even though it's a cryptic message, fans are saying this is the clearest indication yet that Serena will indeed be back for the Australian Open and sporting some pretty cool kicks while she's there down under in Melbourne. Of course, she could be just, you know, selling these new Serena shoes or something.
And another Nike ad.
Maybe another Nike ad if they named a building after her. Maybe she's doing some advertising for Nike. But no, I think fans are taking this as clear an indication as we've had so far that she will be returning to tennis come January in Melbourne for the Australian Open. And Sonny, they are pumped. In less than a day, that photo has already gotten nearly 300,000 likes on Instagram and hundreds of comments. And many of them have one common theme that fans cannot wait to see her back on the court. As one person noted, and I think this is kind of encapsulates all the comments that we're seeing, they write, "The boss is back." And she has been the boss in tennis, and they're hoping that she'll be back.
Well, it's good to keep in mind, she practiced during much of her pregnancy, according to media reports. And I would guess her daughter, maybe shortly after she was born, Andrew, maybe Serena maybe put a little toy tennis racket in the crib.
Yeah, you know, keep in mind that Serena was pregnant when she won the Australian Open last year. I think she was about, 8 or 10 weeks pregnant. So a lot of jokes that her daughter has already won a Grand Slam, even though she wasn't born yet. So we'll see if new mom Serena can maintain and defend her title down under.
What else is trending on this Tuesday, Andrew?
Well, Sonny, the saga of the Ball family continues. Of course, when we last left them, LiAngelo Ball, who was playing for the University of California at Los Angeles, was reportedly pulled out of the school by his, some would say, overbearing and attention-seeking father, LeVar Ball. This came after LiAngelo was suspended from the team for shoplifting during a team trip to China. This feels almost like more like a soap opera recap than a sports story, because there's so many twists and turns and so much that goes on in the story. But anyway, after LiAngelo Ball left UCLA, which is one of the best college programs in the country, fans were perplexed. Why would he leave? Where is he going to go? What school is going to take him? Well, we know now where LiAngelo will be going. He is going pro, because LiAngelo has signed to play professional basketball in none other than, very bizarre, Lithuania.
Lithuania,
and
okay.
His 16-year-old younger brother, LaMelo, will be joining him. They'll be joining Prienų Vytautas, a team that's in the Lithuanian Baltic League, hardly a European powerhouse by any stretch. In fact, as a lot of people noted on social media, there are reports that this team has had serious financial and managerial issues in the past. There are some accounts that players haven't been paid for playing. So once again, fans are perplexed. Why throw away the chance to play in the National Basketball Association, to play at a school like UCLA, and go overseas? A very bizarre move by LeVar Ball to pull his children over there. We'll see if it pays out, but right now a lot of head scratching going on.
And my understanding, Andrew, once you sign a professional contract, you give up your collegiate eligibility, so the younger Ball brothers won't be playing U.S. college basketball, that's for sure.
No, and from what I've read, I believe there's only one U.S. college basketball player who has gone into this Baltic League in Lithuania, and he only stayed there and played for about a month before he left because the league is in such shambles. So, you know, of all of the different clubs overseas in Europe and elsewhere in the world, to put his for LeVar Ball to put his two sons into this club in particular is a very bizarre move. But that has fans talking. What's the hidden angle? Because he's a showman, LeVar Ball. He always is trying to promote his sons.
Right.
So
right.
What does he have up his sleeve? It might end up being the Ball League instead of the Baltic League. We'll see if it happens.
I like that. The Ball League. Andrew Palcheski, the VOA social media reporter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Sonny.
And that wraps up the December 12th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer John Dryden. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent legislative and municipal elections in the Republic of Equatorial Guinea were a chance for the government there to live up to the goal of widening the country's democratic space, a goal that was the focus of Equatorial Guinea's celebrated National Dialogue of 2014. As longtime President Obiang Nguema Mbasogo said at the time, democracy and national unity must be priorities in the problems that affect the nation. Where there are no public liberties, there cannot be institutional development. Unfortunately, as U.S. Ambassador to Equatorial Guinea, Julie Furuta Toy, wrote in a recent op-ed, the opportunity for the government to expand the country's democratic space, demonstrate that it hears the voice and the will of the people, and improve its image on the international stage was missed in November. The elections were a step back, she wrote. The balloting of candidates did not allow the public to vote freely for candidates to represent them at any level, since the voters only had the choice to vote for a party. The members of the public were registered to vote in a process that was not transparent and was not observed by the international or domestic observers. And the final count of the votes was not at all transparent or free. Additionally, restrictions on internet and communication systems were enforced. Reportedly, the Democratic Party of Equatorial Guinea, the party of President Nguema, won the legislative and municipal elections with 92% of the vote. At the Chamber of Deputies in Malabo, only a single member of the opposition from the Citizens' Party for Innovation was elected, leaving 99 seats to the party in power. Ambassador Furuta Toy emphasized that a vibrant and loyal opposition is necessary to create economic opportunities for everyone. Without hearing the voices, without an independent representative democracy, the government limits the ability of its citizens to make informed choices for the future of the nation. As she wrote earlier this year, the greatest resource of Equatorial Guinea is not its abundant supply of oil and gas. The greatest resource of Equatorial Guinea is actually her people, said Ambassador Furuta Toy. It is past time for the leaders of Equatorial Guinea to ensure that Equatorial Guineans are allowed the democratic space required for their country to flourish.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lino Armoudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts covering Africa and the world news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Miller reporting. Voters in the U.S. southern state of Alabama are heading to the polls Tuesday to fill the Senate seat vacated by Jeff Sessions when he became Attorney General. It's an election that could have national implications.